Well, in tonight's study of cults and apologetics, we come to the second cult that I want to discuss over the next few weeks, maybe even several weeks, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or as their belief system is more commonly known, Mormonism. Now, before we get into any of the doctrinal errors promoted by the Mormons, let me first explain their rather bizarre history to you. And remember, we're not here to poke fun at the Mormons. We're not here to make light of the errors that they find themselves embroiled in. We're not here to exercise any sense of superiority over them. But what they believe is really bizarre, and I think we would all do well to know where it all began, how it's all progressed, and where it has ultimately led in their entire belief system. You know, if nothing else, this goes to show just how good Satan is at deception and just how gullible human beings can actually be. And we can all say, but for the grace of God, go with us, right? I've told you before, I'll say it again, I have known a good deal of Mormons over the years, and they're all extremely delightful people. They really are. They're very family-centered. They are very devoted in what they believe. But what they believe is really and truly bizarre. And we're going to see that as we go through this study. Let's begin at the beginning, as they say. Mormonism was founded in the 1820s by a young man named Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith was a farm boy from western New York. If you're up to speed on your history of revivals in America, during the 1820s, this was the same time that the Second Great Awakening was sweeping that entire area. And, of course, swept up by all of the religious fervor of the day, Joseph Smith began praying about which denomination the Lord would have him join. And in the spring of 1820, he allegedly received a vision known as the first vision in their history. This was a vision of God the Father and God the Son, who appeared to him and instructed him not to join any of the existing churches because they were all doctrinally corrupt. And again, this is the way a lot of cults begin. They begin with a wholesale dissatisfaction with all other religions, all other churches, and the only solution to that particular problem is to begin a church of one's own. And if you're a man like Joseph Smith, who was a really imaginative young man, apt to want to accrue praise to himself, very narcissistic, you can see that the makings of a cult leader were there from the very beginning. But we'll talk more about that as we go through this brief history. From the time of this first vision forward, Joseph Smith allegedly received many more angelic visitations, and in each case, he was told that God would reestablish the true Christian church in America through him. And again, this is another hallmark of cult behavior. Joseph Smith just happens to be the one that God would use to reestablish the one true church in America. Not long after he began receiving these angelic visits, Joseph Smith maintained that he found it difficult to stay awake during his chores each day because he was being kept awake all night by the angels who were visiting him. One night in September of 1823, Smith received a special visit from the angel Moroni, who told him about a book that he could find on a hill called Cumora near Palmyra, New York. He was to go to this hill, and he would be directed where to dig, and he would dig, and he would find these golden plates known as the Golden Plates of Nephi. He was told that he could go and dig these things up, but he was not to retrieve them until he was told to do so. So he went to the hill Cumorah. He located these golden plates. And at some later point, he was given permission to retrieve them, and he began translating them from what he said was a Reformed Egyptian language. Now, how did he translate this language, which, by the way, does not exist? There's no such thing as a Reformed Egyptian language. How does he translate this? Well, allegedly he did this with the help of two kinds of stones. First, he had a seer stone, or as they often referred to them, a peeker stone. That's right. He would take this stone, he would place it along with the text to be translated on a plate or on papyrus or whatever the case might be. He would place both in the hat, and he would put the hat securely on his face and cancel out all the light around him, and he was shown what the translation of this thing was. If he wasn't using his seeker stone or his seer stone or his peeker stone, then he would use what he called the Urim and Thummim. Now, if you're at all familiar with your Old Testament, as you should be, you'll know that the Urim and Thummim is actually a biblical reference to the breastplate worn by the high priest. On this breastplate, there were stones arrayed. I think it was six stones, three on either side. And it was used for the purposes of temple worship during the Day of Atonement. Joseph Smith insisted that along with these plates came these glasses that contained the stones from the Urim and Thummim. He could put these glasses on and it would accomplish the same thing as the seer stone would. He could put these glasses on and he could look at this Reformed Egyptian writing and tell you exactly what it said and translate it into English. Sounds far-fetched, but again, that's what people believe actually happened. Let's just stop here just a minute for a quick doctrine check, right? This is a study of cults and apologetics. So we have to ask ourselves, and we have to ask this throughout our study, the teaching of the Book of Mormon clearly represents a gospel that differs in all the wrong ways from the biblical gospel. And this particular gospel was first revealed to Joseph Smith by angels. Does that sound familiar to a warning that the Apostle Paul gave the Galatians? Look at Galatians 1. Galatians 1, verses 6 through 9. Galatians 1, beginning at verse 6. By the way, Moroni, this angel that appeared to Joseph Smith, is allegedly the son of another angel named Mormon. That's where the name comes from. Anyway, Galatians 1, verse 6. Note what Paul said to the Galatians. He said, "I'm amazed that you're so quickly deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ for a different gospel, which is really not another, only there are some who are disturbing you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. But even if we, or an angel from heaven, should preach to you a gospel contrary to what we have preached to you, he is to be accursed. As we have said before, so I say again now, if any man is preaching to you a gospel contrary to what you received, he is to be accursed." It doesn't get any clearer than this. This is a clear warning, not just to the Galatians, but to subsequent generations of believers, that the one true gospel appears on the pages of Holy Scripture. And even if an angel comes to you and says, "Oh, but we have another gospel," which, remember, the Book of Mormon is called Another Testament of Jesus Christ. Had Joseph Smith been even remotely acquainted with the New Testament, he would have seen danger signs all over the place. Had any of those initial followers of Joseph Smith been up to snuff in regard to their own understanding of the New Testament, they too would have been able to warn him and say, "No, this is demonic. This is not of the Lord. This is clearly a different gospel brought to you in the very same way that Paul warned against accepting that gospel And so, again, Joseph Smith did not know of this particular warning, obviously, or he didn't care and decided to create his own religion anyway. So where did Joseph Smith get the idea that he could use a seer stone or this Urim and Thummim to translate ancient Egyptian writing? Well, he no doubt got this from his father, Joseph Smith Sr. The elder Joseph Smith was a very well-known mystic, and he spent most of his time digging for imaginary buried treasure. And when I say imaginary buried treasure, I really mean that. He didn't have any archaeological evidence to go on. He had no treasure maps. He had the idea that he could just put a rock in his hat and look at it long enough and then go to where he thought he should go and start digging. As a matter of fact, there are all kinds of craters still in and around that area from these digs that he would commit himself to. And guess how much treasure he found over his lifetime? Zero. Zilch. Nada. Right? But nonetheless, this influence was very persuasive to young Joseph Smith. What son doesn't want to be like his father in terms of things like this? And so Joseph Smith had his own imagination and his own way of copying that which he saw in his father. So, back to Joseph Smith's translation of the golden plates of Nephi. Joseph Smith recognized early on that for him to go at this as a lone ranger of sorts would not bode well for the development of a religion. And so he enlisted the help of a young man named Oliver Cowdery. Oliver Cowdery would allow Joseph Smith to go behind a curtain and translate these ancient Egyptian writings. And Oliver Cowdery would take dictation. He would write it all down. Before long, Oliver Cowdery himself became a convert and began following very closely everything that Joseph Smith taught. One problem was, later on in his own memoirs, Oliver Cowdery said that he never saw any of the source material that Joseph Smith said he was translating. He never saw any golden plates. Never saw any papyrus, never saw any of these ancient Egyptian writings. He simply took Joseph Smith's word for it. How convenient. And where are the golden plates today? Who knows? I think their doctrine actually says that they were taken away by the angels. And so, how convenient for that to happen, right? Well, this work continued. And on May 15th, 1829, Smith and Cowdery, now in Pennsylvania, were visited by John the Baptist himself. John the Baptist announced that he had been sent to them by Peter, James, and John. And John the Baptist's mission, I know, yeah, it's unbelievable, right? But their mission at this particular point was to confer the Aaronic priesthood on Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery. I'd say that you can't make this stuff up, but it's fairly clear that you can, right? Anyway, Smith baptized Cowdery and vice versa. They baptized each other. Not sure why you wouldn't have John the Baptist. He's right there. I mean that, though. Again, I'm not poking fun. I mean, if you're going to concoct a story where you're visited by John the Baptist and you're going to be baptized, wouldn't you have the big man do it? You would think, right? They end up baptizing themselves, and the grand illusion continued to take further shape. By 1830, the work of translation was complete, and the Book of Mormon was published for the first time. Shortly thereafter, Smith, Cowdery, Smith's brothers Hiram and Samuel, along with David and Peter Whitmer, officially founded a new religious society. Originally, this group was known as the Church of Christ. You might be surprised to know that one of the initial adherents to this new movement was a guy by the name of Campbell. Campbell is actually the beginner of the Church of Christ as we know it today. The Church of Christ today, the people that attend Churches of Christ are known as Campbellites. And that goes way back to then. Now, he wasn't as off the mark as Joseph Smith, ended up breaking away, but there is some similarity there. I suspect that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints changed their name from the Church of Christ so as to not be confused with Campbell's later work. But they went through a couple of iterations. They went from the Church of Christ to becoming known as the Church of Latter-day Saints, and finally to their current designation, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Shortly after the meeting to officially organize the church, the nucleus of the church moved to Kirtland, Ohio. Within 6 years, the church had more than 16,000 members. It was from this headquarters that the church expanded into Jackson County, Missouri, where Joseph Smith had purchased 63 acres, which he referred to as holy ground. Now, at this point, you are probably wondering, well, how does a movement like this gain any traction? I mean, it's patently absurd what's being said. How is it that a movement like this can possibly gain any traction? But remember, this is the Second Great Awakening. Unlike the First Great Awakening, the Second Great Awakening, historically speaking, was a theological disaster. It was a train wreck. I mean, if you think about it, the Second Great Awakening gave us men like Charles Grandison Finney, Harry Emerson Fosdick, and other people who should not have been in ministry at all. It was really an attempt to kind of mimic the First Great Awakening that in many ways went bad. And so you've got all this religious fervor. It's also, if you're familiar with your history, around the 1820s, 1830s, this is also the beginning of a new era philosophically. We're no longer in the pre-modern era, now we're in the modern era, which gave rise to the Enlightenment in Europe. It gave rise to technology and technological advances such as the world had never seen. It's around this same time frame that electricity is being promoted and the telephone is invented, and you see all this stuff going on in terms of other developments in other scientific disciplines. It's really kind of a renaissance in America. And so you've got people who really and truly are willing to fall for almost anything. They're seeing things that they never dreamed were possible. And so this was the right time for Satan to introduce something like this, because its appeal was enormous to people who had grown tired of that old-time religion. They wanted something new, and this fit the bill. So much so that, again, 16,000 members in 6 years. That's quite the growth spurt. But they eventually, again, moved their headquarters, expanding into Jackson County, Missouri, where this piece of land was bought. Kirtland, Ohio was also the birthplace of the first Stake of Zion. If you don't know what that is, this is the first selection of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It's their first selection of 12 apostles who would serve as the leadership council for the church. Just for the record, it's certainly worth noting why the church moved to Ohio in the first place. They made the move because of Joseph Smith's unpopularity. Something the Mormons will not talk about today. They don't like talking about it. Joseph Smith had to move from New York and Philadelphia into Ohio because he was so unpopular among the people that knew him. And that should tell you a lot as well. Most of the people of Jackson County, Missouri, the place they were at before they moved into Ohio, considered Smith and his new religion to be a sham, a hoax. They wanted nothing to do with it or him. And of course, being the snake oil salesman that he was, Smith concocted a much better reason for the move. Why do you suppose he moved in his own way of thinking? Ah, to find the Holy Land. Close. He moved because God told him to move. Right? I've had a revelation. So we're moving shop. We're going to move. You know, he couldn't very well say, I'm moving because everybody hates me. Right? And I'm becoming more and more unpopular as the days go by. So he concocted this vision where he said, we're moving, and we're moving to Ohio. It was because of Smith's alleged revelations that he and the church were able to be successful, not only in Kirtland, Ohio, but in one of their final destinations, which was Nauvoo, Illinois. It's a very well-known Mormon metropolis. Anyway, back to Ohio. It was in Kirtland that Joseph Smith, again, as a result of divine revelation, codified the practice of polygamy among the Mormons. Joseph Smith himself was a polygamist, saw nothing wrong with having multiple wives, and this was a teaching in the early church. And Joseph Smith, as the reigning prophet of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, declared in the same fashion as the Pope declares things ex cathedra, he declared infallibly that polygamy was the will of God. That is until 1890, when Mormon President Wilford Woodruff changed that particular belief because it was no longer politically expedient for them to believe in polygamy. Everywhere they went, they were being run out of town because they were polygamists. Polygamy to this day, as far as I know, is illegal in every state. Right? And so, again, in 1890, this infallible declaration by Joseph Smith was changed. That's just one of many examples that we can see in Mormonism of their changing beliefs based solely on the direction of the political winds or on economic survival, right? So what's the reason for all this moving around from place to place? Well, again, Joseph was not welcome really anywhere he went. Before long, people began rejecting him. You know, that is, people who weren't bound up in this religious movement, they began rejecting him. As one author of the day noted in his book on Mormonism, Joseph Smith Jr. was known, quote, for his habits of exaggeration and untruthfulness. Smith was further credited, the author writes, with being able to utter the most palpable exaggeration or marvelous absurdity with the utmost apparent gravity. In fact, Smith's reputation was so damaged that there was no one who would come to his defense. As word began to spread in New York about Joseph Smith's reputation, it wasn't long before others started sounding the alarm. In fact, the newspaper in Nauvoo, Illinois, which was called the Nauvoo Expositor, became one of Joseph Smith's greatest enemies. One of his most formidable foes was the press. They couldn't stand the man. And mainly because of his beliefs in polygamy and otherwise in his basically taking over the city of Nauvoo, Illinois. If you know anything about the history of that particular city, at this point, the Nauvoo City Council was all Mormon. And guess who the mayor was of Nauvoo? Joseph Smith. He had wormed his way. He tried to make Nauvoo, Illinois his own Geneva, as Calvin did, right? And he was successful for a time, even so successful that he convinced the city council that the only way to stop the persecution of the Mormons was to destroy the printing press at the Nauvoo Expositor. And so Joseph Smith amassed a rabble of people, and they went into the printing press. They drug the press out itself into the street, and they destroyed it. And then they drug out all the existing newspapers on record, and they burned them. And they would have gotten away with that, at least locally, if it wasn't for the intervention of the federal government. The federal government came in and said, no, you can't do that. So what did they do? The federal government threw Joseph and his brother Hiram in jail. And the people of Nauvoo were so incensed, many of them Masons, because Joseph Smith, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but a lot of the writing in the Book of Mormon has Masonic origins. Joseph Smith was a failed Masonic Lodge member who began spouting all of their secrets and writing them down in his own book, insisting that they were his own ideas. And so this crowd of more than 200 men broke into the jail and killed Joseph and his brother. Now, I wish that hadn't happened. Why? Well, for obvious reasons. I mean, no one deserves to die for what they believe. But they made him a martyr. They made him a saint. And so now, he's on the par with Jesus himself at this point. He died for our faith. And that's the way that story is told among the Mormons even today, that he's a great martyr of the faith, and he's to be honored as such. Well, this led to the installment of another prominent Mormon figure, a 43-year-old man named Brigham Young. The University of BYU, Brigham Young University, bears his name to this day. Only 2 years after Brigham Young was installed, the church chose to abandon Nauvoo, Illinois. Wise choice. And they moved, you guessed it, to Salt Lake City. Brigham Young visited there. You got to understand, back then, this was before Utah was officially a state. This was actually very early on, when there was nothing in the Salt Lake area but the Salt Lake and a bunch of beautiful mountains. And once he got there, he said, "This is it. This is the place." And so they established the church again there in the Salt Lake area. I'm not going to take the time to give you a whole lot of information about Brigham Young beyond that, but one thing is important in terms of how the Mormons have rewritten their history over the years. When Brigham Young assumed the mantle of the prophet of the Mormon church, he took his responsibilities very seriously. It was Brigham Young's idea that not just the Salt Lake area, but the whole state of Utah would be a Mormon stronghold. How seriously did he take that? Well, he took it so seriously that he hired one of his bishops, John D. Lee, to go out, and as wagon trains of immigrants were making their way into the Salt Lake Valley, he killed more than 100 of them to prevent them from coming and intermingling with the Mormons. And again, the Mormons won't tell you that story, but it's well documented. Well documented. It's known as the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And it happened under the watchful eye of Brigham Young. Of course, he needed a hitman. John D. Lee was that hitman. 20 years later, the wheels of justice sometimes run very slowly. 20 years later, John D. Lee was tried, convicted, imprisoned, and later executed by the federal government for his part in the massacre. Again, part of their history you're not going to hear probably at Brigham Young, right? So that's basically the 35,000-foot overview of Mormon history. Let's begin now to look at what they believe. What do they have as their religious texts? Well, they have more than just the Book of Mormon, which is touted as another gospel, another testament of Jesus Christ. They also have the King James Bible, which they believe is the Word of God, but only insofar as it's interpreted correctly. See, that's another hallmark of cults and cultism. They'll agree that the Bible is the inerrant and infallible Word of God, but only insofar as you interpret it correctly. What that means is, that's just code for, if we disagree with you on a doctrinal issue, it's because you are not interpreting it correctly. Right? Again, it's another very common tactic. This is why the New World Translation was written by the Jehovah's Witnesses, because they insisted that theirs is the only viable translation of the Hebrew and the Greek. which is not true at all. As a matter of fact, we demonstrated that quite clearly. Well, in addition to the King James and the Book of Mormon, they also have the Doctrine and Covenants and the Pearl of Great Price. These three books, the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, and the Pearl of Great Price, make up their triad of religious texts in addition to the Bible itself. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about the Doctrine and Covenants or the Pearl of Great Price, because much of what's taught there is from the Book of Mormon. So as we delve into this, we're going to talk more about the Book of Mormon than we do those other things, although those will come to bear at certain points in this study. So what is the Book of Mormon exactly? Well, this is where things get weird again. The Book of Mormon purports to be a history of two ancient civilizations that are located on the continent of America. Now, you know, we separate the continent of America into North, Central, and South America. When I say the continent of America, I'm including all three. Apparently, according to the Mormons, the first of these great civilizations, known as the Jaredites, left the Tower of Babel sometime around 2500 BC, crossed over into Europe, and immigrated to the east coast of what we now recognize as Central America. The second group, known simply as the Righteous Jews, supposedly left Jerusalem sometime around 600 BC. And again, if you're up to speed on your history, you know that the sacking of Jerusalem in 586 BC by Nebuchadnezzar, this is before that. Remember, the clock ticks backwards when you're looking at BC as opposed to AD. And so they barely made it out, you know, with 14 years to spare. They made it out, and they actually came to, not to Central America, but they allegedly, under the leadership of Nephi, crossed the Pacific Ocean and settled in the area that we know as the west coast of South America. The Book of Mormon was written by a prophet named Mormon, and it was intended to serve as a history for these two groups of people. Now, what became of these ancient civilizations? Well, again, this is very convenient. The reason there's no historical record of these ancient civilizations, the Jaredites and the Righteous Jews led by Nephi, the real reason is they never existed to begin with. The other reason you don't see, according to the Mormons, the reason you don't see a lot historically about them is because they were actually wiped out, annihilated, because of their corruption and apostasy. Now, the second group ended up splitting into two groups, the Nephites and the Lamanites. The Lamanites are said to be the first Native Americans or Indians. And according to Mormon doctrine, the Lamanites were punished by God and received the curse of dark skin, while the Nephites were visited by Jesus, who preached to them and instituted both baptism and the Lord's Supper. For years, so many years, the Mormons insisted that the righteous before God were those who were fair and delightsome, meaning they had fair skin and fair features. Any dark skin meant that you were cursed by God. Now, you know where that stems from. Joseph Smith himself was a virulent racist. You know, this has kind of undertones of Arianism, not the ancient theological heresy, but the heresy promoted by Hitler himself about the superior nature of the Aryan race, which, by the way, most of us here in this room would not even qualify for that particular race, because we're talking about blonde hair and blue eyes and very fair skin. Those were seen as optimal. Well, the Mormon church carried on that same sort of belief. And so again, for the longest time, people of color were not welcome in the Mormon church by fiat decree, by infallible decree of their prophet. This was not to happen. Then what happened? The political wind shifted. It became economically unviable for them to keep prohibiting people of color from coming into the Mormon church, and so they welcomed them with open arms. The doctrine changed all of a sudden. Anyway, once Jesus visited these Nephites and gave them baptism in the Lord's Supper, the Lamanites were jealous, and they ended up annihilating the Nephites in a great battle. And where do you think this battle took place? This battle took place near Palmyra, New York. That's where Joseph found the tablets, the golden plates of Nephi. When did it happen? It happened in 385 AD. How do we know? Because Joseph Smith says so. How do we know archaeologically? We don't. How do we know historically? We don't. Folks, we can't even trace anything in America back to 385. I mean, certain Native American tribes and their pottery and their arrowheads and things. Yeah, we know that there were people here. But as far as this great civilization and this great cataclysmic war that happened between the Lamanites and the Nephites, there's no record of that. It's just spun out of whole cloth. It comes directly from the imagination of Joseph Smith, who again was very good in that department. Now let me just clarify something about these golden plates that Joseph Smith found 1,400 years after this alleged battle. Although these golden plates are most commonly referred to as the golden plates of Nephi, there are actually four categories of golden plates. One, the plates of Nephi. Two, the plates of Mormon. Three, the plates of Ether. And four, the plates of brass, otherwise known as the plates of Laban. So what are we to make of all this? Is there any legitimacy to the claims of the Mormons surrounding their book's authenticity? The short answer is no. There's not. And over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be looking at this from three different perspectives. I want to look at this very closely, and I want to scrutinize their claims under the heading of science, which would be archaeology and anthropology. I also want to examine their claims on the basis of linguistics. What do we know about language today that apparently we don't know about what Joseph Smith was doing? And thirdly, I want to look at it from a scriptural perspective. What does Scripture say? Remember, our presupposition going into this is that Scripture and Scripture alone is our only infallible rule of judging anything. And it's a reliable, historically proven means of determining the truth. It really is. So we're going to look at it from those perspectives. Just to whet your appetite a bit, I want to read you something from Walter Martin's classic, The Kingdom of the Cults. And I want to read you something that pertains to the reliability of the Book of Mormon from a linguistic perspective. And I'll have more to say about this, but just to get your mind going in the right direction here, let me just read what Martin says here. He says, in an attempt to validate and justify the claims of the Book of Mormon, the highest authority in Mormonism, Joseph Smith, the Mormon prophet, related an event which, if true, would add significant weight to some of the Mormon claims for their Bible. Fortunately, it's a fact on which a good deal of evidence can be brought to bear. Smith put forth his claim in the book, The Pearl of Great Price, and it's worthwhile to examine it. Here's what Smith said. He says, I commenced copying the characters off of the plates. I copied a considerable number of them, and by means of the Urim and Thummim, I translated some of them, Mr. Martin Harris came to our place, got the characters which I had drawn off the plates, and started with them to the city of New York. For what took place relative to him and the characters, I refer to his own account of the circumstances as he related them to me after his return, which was as follows. Now, this is Martin Harris telling us what he did with these characters that were taken off of the plates. He says, I went to the city of New York and presented the characters which had been translated with the translation thereof to Professor Charles Anthon, a gentleman celebrated for his literary attainments. Professor Anthon stated that the translation was correct, more so than any he had before seen translated from the Egyptian. It sounds kind of like Donald Trump, doesn't it? Oh, this was a good translation. This was the best translation you ever saw. This is the best of the best translations. Anyway, you need to be wary of people who overdo things. Isn't it enough just to say he agreed with the translation? Of course it is. I then showed him those which were not yet translated, and he said that they were Egyptian, Chaldaic, Assyriac, and Arabic. And he said that they were true characters. That'd be a great report, wouldn't it? I mean, you took these things to a very learned linguistics guy, and he says, yea, verily, this is all true. Yay, Book of Mormon. Martin continues, according to Joseph Smith, then, Martin Harris, his colleague, obtained from the learned Professor Charles Anthon of Columbia University a validation of Smith's translation of the Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphic characters found on the plates which Mormon or Moroni gave to him. The difficulty with Smith's statement is that Professor Anthon never said any such thing. And fortunately, he went on record in a lengthy letter to Mr. E.D. Howe, a contemporary of Joseph Smith, who did one of the most thorough jobs of research on the Mormon prophet and the origins of Mormonism extant. Howe has never been refuted, and because of this, he is feared and hated by Mormon historians and not a few contemporary Mormons. Upon learning of Smith's claim concerning Professor Anthon, Mr. Howe wrote to him at Columbia. Want to get away, right? Professor Anthon's letter, reproduced here from Howe's own collection, is a classic piece of evidence the Mormons would like very much to see forgotten. Here's the letter. Dear sir, I received this morning your favor of the 9th instant and lose no time in making a reply. The whole story about my having pronounced the Mormonite inscription to be Reformed Egyptian hieroglyphics is perfectly false. Some years ago, a plain and apparently simple-hearted farmer called upon me with a note from Dr. Mitchell of our city, now deceased, requesting me to decipher, if possible, a paper which the farmer would hand to me, and which Dr. Mitchell confessed he had been unable to understand. Upon examining the paper in question, I soon came to the conclusion that it was all a trick, perhaps a hoax. When I asked the person who brought it how he obtained the writing, he gave me, as far as I can now recollect, the following account. A gold book, consisting of a number of plates of gold fastened together in the shape of a book by wires of the same metal, had been dug up in the northern part of the state of New York, and along with the book, an enormous pair of gold spectacles. These spectacles were so large that if a person attempted to look through them, his two eyes would have to be turned toward one of the glasses, merely the spectacles in question being altogether too large for the breadth of the human face. Whoever examined the plates through the spectacles was enabled not only to read them, but to fully understand their meaning. All this knowledge, however, was confined at the time to a young man who had the trunk containing the book and spectacles in his sole possession. This young man was placed behind a curtain in the garret of a farmhouse, and being thus concealed from view, put on the spectacles occasionally, or rather looked through one of the glasses, deciphered the characters in the book, and having committed some of them to paper, handed copies from behind the curtain to those who stood on the outside. Not a word, however, was said about the plates having been deciphered by the gift of God. Everything in this way was affected by the large pair of spectacles. The farmer added that he had been requested to contribute a sum of money toward the publication of the Golden Book, the contents of which would, as he had been assured, produce an entire change in the world and save it from ruin. So urgent had been these solicitations that he intended selling his farm and handing over the amount received to those who wished to publish the plates. As a last precautionary step, however, he had resolved to come to New York and obtain the opinion of the learned about the meaning of the paper which he brought with him and which had, he had been given as a part of the contents of the book, although no translation had been furnished at the time by the young man with the spectacles. On hearing this odd story, I changed my opinion about the paper, and instead of viewing it any longer as a hoax upon the learned, I began to regard it as part of a scheme to cheat the farmer out of his money, and I communicated my suspicions to him, warning him to beware of rogues. He requested an opinion from me in writing, which of course I declined giving, and he then took his leave, carrying the paper with him. This paper was in fact a singular scrawl. It consisted of all kinds of crooked characters disposed in columns and had evidently been prepared by some person who had before him at the time a book containing various alphabets, Greek and Hebrew letters, crosses and flourishes. Roman letters inverted or placed sideways were arranged in perpendicular columns, and the whole ended in a rude delineation of a circle divided into various compartments, decked with various strange marks, and evidently copied after the Mexican calendar given by Humboldt, but copied in such a way as not to betray the source whence it was derived. He's talking about the Aztec calendar. Remember that round thing with all the weird shapes on it? I am thus particular as to the contents of the paper, inasmuch as I frequently converse with my friends on the subject. Since the Mormonite excitement began, and well remember that the paper contained anything else but Egyptian hieroglyphics. Sometime after, the same farmer paid me a second visit. He brought with him a golden book in print and offered it to me for sale. I declined purchasing. He then asked permission to leave the book with me for examination. I declined receiving it, although his manner was strangely urgent. I adverted once more to the roguery which had been, in my opinion, practiced upon him, and asked what had become of the golden plates. He informed me that they were in a trunk with a large pair of spectacles. I advised him to go to a magistrate and have the trunk examined. He said the curse of God would come upon him should he do this. Another practice of the cults. Threaten people with death if they reveal their sources, right? On my pressing him, however, to pursue the course which I had recommended, he told me that he would open the trunk if I would take the curse of God upon myself. I replied that I would do so with the greatest willingness and would incur every risk of that nature, provided I could only extricate him from the grasp of the rogues. He then left me. I have thus given you a full statement of all that I know respecting the origin of Mormonism, and must beg you as a personal favor to publish this letter immediately should you find my name mentioned again by these wretched fanatics. Yours respectfully, Charles Anton, Columbia University. Martin goes on to say, Professor Anton's letter is both revealing and devastating where Smith's and Harris's veracity are concerned. We might also raise the question as to how Professor Anthon could say that the character shown him by Martin Harris and authorized by Joseph Smith as part of the material copied from the Revelation of the First Book of Mormon were Egyptian, Chaldaic, Assyriac, and Arabic, when the Book of Mormon itself declares that the characters were Reformed Egyptian. The language of the Nephites. Since the language of the Book of Mormon was known to none other people, how would it be conceivably possible for Professor Anthon to have testified as to the accuracy of Smith's translation? To this date, no one has ever been able to find even the slightest trace of the language known as Reformed Egyptian, and all reputable linguists who have examined the evidence put forth by the Mormons have rejected them as mythical. Long story short, what did Joseph Smith do? He jotted down a bunch of jibber-jabber in various fonts, from the Syriac, from the Arabic, from other languages, none of them, by the way, hieroglyphics. And he labeled it all as Reformed Egyptian. He was found out by a professor. They tried to pass the professor's testimony off in another way as to be able to authenticate the book, but it was all proven to be a lie. So, from a linguistic perspective, I think we can make an open and shut case for the fact that there is no linguistic basis for the Book of Mormon, at least in that regard. Anyway, that's all I got for tonight. We're going to continue this in over the next several weeks. I think it's just fascinating, if nothing else. And again, remember the one cardinal rule here. We need to remember, but for the grace goeth I, the grace of God goeth I. You know, we're all subject to being hoodwinked if we're not careful. Recognize the times that this was in, and you'll see fairly quickly that these were confusing times. And so what's especially pernicious about the Mormon Church is that they keep promoting these and other clear errors that can be shown, as we'll see in the coming weeks, to be erroneous. And yet they just continue promoting these things.